Thanks to everyone for being here. I'm going to read this talk. Hopefully that won't be super boring. There's a handout which has all of the numbered claims on it, so I will just refer to those. Just a little note about the organization of the talk. There's a kind of initial introduction to the larger paper of which this is a part, and it's not really important that you follow that, and then there's an introduction to what I'm actually going to talk about today. All right, so Carnapian views in meta-ontology have been thriving in recent decades. While these neo-Carnapians differ in many important ways, they all trace the inspiration for their views back to Carnap's 1950 paper, Empiricism, Semantics, and Ontology. The basic idea of Carnap 1950 was that we can do ontology by distinguishing between ontological questions asked within a linguistic framework, for instance, once we've decided to speak a Platonist language, and ontological questions asked outside such a framework, for instance, when we are deciding whether to speak a Platonist language. Within a framework, ontological questions have determinate answers. Outside of any such framework, they are to be understood as practical questions about which framework we ought to adopt. We can thus answer ontological questions, for instance, are there numbers, without appealing to mysterious epistemic capacities, like a nonsensical intuition of the mathematical realm. I think that these neo-Carnapian views inherit from their mentor a deep inconsistency. They are committed to the possibility of alien languages, in the technical sense that I will specify, but the possibility of such languages is incompatible with other components of their view. This problem is analogous to Donald Davidson's argument against radically different conceptual schemes in his classic paper on the very idea of conceptual scheme. I will not discuss the relation of my argument to Davidson today, though, except to say that as I read him, Davidson either argues for a merely epistemic conclusion, we could never know of a community that it speaks a radically alien language, or reaches a not merely epistemic conclusion, such an alien language is incoherent or impossible, through an implicit verificationist principle. If a radically alien language is empirically unverifiable, the very idea of such a language is incoherent or impossible. My argument, by contrast, will be for a non-epistemic conclusion, but without making any verificationist assumptions. In the longer and yet unfinished paper of which this talk is a part, I argue that this problem generalizes to other neo-Carnapian views in meta-ontology, for instance, those of Eli Hirsch, as well as for Carnap himself. But today I will concentrate on the work of a prominent neo-Carnapian, Amy Thomason. Okay, if you didn't understand any of that, doesn't matter. Now I'll get to the introduction of what I'm actually going to talk about. It's customary in papers like this to have a little section where you give your reading of Carnap 1950. I'm going to skip that. I'm just going to talk about Amy Thomason. Ever since the pioneering work of David Lewis, there has been a resurgence of interest in ontological questions. Much of this revival took its methodological bearings from a particular reading, or as it were, misreading, of Quine's 1948 paper on What There Is, on which the way to answer ontological questions is to infer to the theory that provides the best overall explanation of the data, and then read your ontological commitments off the quantifiers of that theory. Whatever you need to quantify over for your theory to be true is what you are ontologically committed to. Quine recommended this as a way of determining the ontological commitments of empirical scientific theories and held that any two theories that are empirically equivalent have the same content. He would have thus rejected as contentless any theorizing about entities that do not make a difference to empirical science. However, his epigonies in post-Lewisian metaphysics have extended this method to ontological questions that have little or no bearing on empirically verifiable scientific theories. For instance, are there arbitrary mereological fusions, instantaneous temporal parts, merely possible individuals? One natural response to this profusion of armchair ontology is to think that there is something wrong with these debates, and one natural person to turn to for resources for articulating that response is Carnap. There are many different kinds of neo-Carnapian views in meta-ontology, from Amy Thomason's easy approach to ontology, to Eli Hirsch's quantifier variance version, to David Chalmers' ontological internalism, and to the works of Cambridge's own Hugh Price. What unites them is the shared rejection of post-Lewisian ontological orthodoxy and a commitment to something like a Carnapian distinction between internal and external existence questions. In this paper, I'm going to focus on Amy Thomason as my representative neo-Carnapian. In her 2014 book, Thomason pursues a broadly Carnapian approach to ontology. In other works, she extends this framework to modality. In broad strokes, her view is that many questions in philosophical ontology, for instance, are there numbers? Are there complex material objects? Have easy answers. The semantic rules of our language, combined with trivial empirical truths, entail that there are, for instance, numbers, tables, chairs, properties, etc. There is no great discovery in finding out that tables or numbers exist. on Thomason's view, because given the semantic rules of our language, this is an immediate consequence of truths accepted even by the theorist who denies that numbers or tables exist. Both Thomason and the nihilist about composition, let us assume, accept one, there are particles arranged table-wise. Thomason claims that the following is a semantic rule of our language. Two, if there are particles arranged table-wise, then there is a table. From which it follows trivially, three, there is a table. Noting this trivial inference is all it takes, according to Thomason, to prove that tables exist. The nihilist about tables will, of course, reject two. On Thomason's view, however, two is a semantic rule of our language, partly constitutive of the meanings of its terms, for instance, table and arranged table-wise, just as bachelors or unmarried men is partly constitutive of the meaning of the term bachelor. One can reject two only at the price of changing the meanings of the terms as one uses them, i.e. speaking a subtly different, albeit homophonic, language. In other words, on Thomason's view, the compositional nihilist who rejects two and proclaims there are no tables, only particles arranged table-wise, is either mistaken about the rules of her own language, comparable to the child who insists that Mother Teresa was a bachelor, or is speaking a subtly different language. In the latter case, she is not in fact disagreeing with the theorist who asserts there is a table, because table has a different meaning in the nihilist's language. Although the sentences they utter are homophones, they are pronounced and written the same way, the nihilist and the ordinary speaker are making different claims and thus not truly contradicting one another. Thomason's view is Carnapian in that it uses the semantic rules of our language and their roles as meaning constitutive to dispel certain ontological debates, i.e. whether complex material objects exist. On Thomason's view, the compositional nihilist is either speaking our language, in which case she is simply mistaken, or she is speaking a subtly different language, in which she is talking past us. Thus, within Thomason's view, we can distinguish between an internal reading of the question, are there tables, on which we evaluate the meaning of this question using the rules of our language, and an external reading on which we are doing something akin to asking whether we should speak a language governed by the rules of our actual language. Likewise, Thomason's view issues in a Carnap-style distinction between easy, Carnap's terms, analytic ontological claims, and less easy, in Carnap's terms, empirical ontological claims. It is easy to answer the question, are there numbers, because it only requires knowledge of the rules of our language. By contrast, answering the question, what is the number of piano tuners in Dresden, is not quite so easy. To do that, we need some experience. We need to go count the piano tuners in Dresden, or look at the Yellow Pages, or something like that. So we have, once again, the distinction among internal ontological questions, those asked within a language, between those that can be answered by the rules alone, and those that can only be answered by the rules plus experience. It is crucial to Thomason's view that semantic rules can be ontologically ampliative. They warrant inferences from sentences that are not ontologically committed to entities of a certain kind, to sentences that are. While Carnap is not fully committal on this in Empiricism of Semantics and Ontology, Thomason's view centrally depends upon it. For a given class of philosophically problematic entities, the Ks, there can be introduction principles by which you go from K-free sentences to sentences that quantify over Ks or include singular terms referring to Ks. And I've given some examples of this on the handout. Numbers. If f and g are equinumerous, if and only if the number of f's equals the number of g's. Material objects. If there are parts arranged table-wise, then there are tables. For all x, if fx, then x has the property f. Some theorists assume that these introduction principles must be biconditionals and that they must take the form of abstraction principles, as in 1. However, Thomason is not committed to either assumption, so I will not foist them upon her, and it won't make any difference to my argument. One of the principal motivations for Thomason's view is to avoid epistemically metaphysical questions that arise from more orthodox Neo-Aquinians like David Lewis and Ted Sider. A question is epistemically metaphysical, just in case answering that question would require epistemic capacities beyond knowledge of the semantic rules of one's language, ordinary experience, and empirical science. Since arguably the boundaries between the more theoretical reaches of natural sciences like physics and metaphysics can be somewhat vague, I will count any question that could not in principle be answered by any empirical scientific investigation as epistemically metaphysical in Thomason's sense. Making ontology safe for empiricist epistemology constitutes one of the main motivations of her view. In this respect, Thomason is again very much in the Carnapian tradition, for the motivating question of Carnap in 1950 is how to accommodate a Platonist ontology in mathematics with an empiricist epistemology. Some less deflationary metaphysicians respond to views like Thomason's by claiming that it renders objects like tables, chairs, and numbers mind or language independent, because their existence is secured by semantic rules of our language. But surely that is not right, they object. Surely these objects exist out there, whether or not we speak about them, in whatever language we choose to speak. There are two forms this mind independence objection might take, and I think that in both forms it fails. I'm going to largely skip this because this is relatively familiar stuff from the literature, and we can discuss it in the Q&A if you want. The basic idea is the fact that three follows from one and two does not make three contingent upon our speaking the language we do. We could have spoken a language in which two is false, but that doesn't mean there's a possible world in which two is false. When we say what's true at a possible world, we use the language that we actually speak. That's why we say of a world that contains only XYZ, that it does not contain any water, even though the speakers in that world might all use the term water to refer to XYZ. The other thing that people say is that although it doesn't make three contingent, it makes three dependent upon our choice of language. So it might not entail a false modal claim about the existence of tables, but it entails a false dependence claim. But Thomason's view is not that two is made true by a fact about our language. Thomason has no notion of truth making in her theory. So if anything, two and two star, so the dependence objection is that two is made true by two star, and since two entails three, three is indirectly made true by two star. But Thomason's view is not that two is made true by two star. Her view is that two and two star are the same fact. They're two different ways of saying the same thing. So there's no explanatory relationship between the semantic rules of our language and the existence of tables. There's only an entailment relation that we can know trivially. Okay, so those points have been covered by Thomason and Hirsch and other people at length. I don't want to focus on those. Nonetheless, the impression persists, at least among some of us, that Thomason's view internalizes objects within languages, that it makes it impossible for us to even talk about the world as it is in itself. Thomason will, of course, dismiss this complaint, as I have formulated it, as confused. The desire to speak of the world, independently of how you speak about it, is arguably incoherent. Nonetheless, I think there is a way to get at the thought behind this complaint, not by distinguishing the object as we conceive it or talk about it from the object as it is in itself, which may involve the incoherent thought of talking about objects independently of how we talk about them, but by distinguishing different languages that can be applied to the same object or objects. One role that the idea of objects in themselves, if this idea is even coherent, is supposed to play is that of a common topic or target of thought by different speakers. This table, it's great, the great thing about philosophy talks is you know there's always going to be a table to refer to, right? This table is not internal to my language because both you and I can speak about it. Thomason's view has no trouble accommodating common objects of talk among speakers of the same language, for the language includes semantic rules governing identities for such objects. For instance, if X is a table and Y is a table, and X and Y are composed of the same parts at the same time, they are the same table. But we can also consider relations between our language and other languages. Thomason considers several alternate languages, for instance, the nominalist language that lacks singular terms for numbers, the nihilist language that lacks singular terms for complex objects. But all of these languages have some terms in common with ours. This is why we can make sense of speakers of those languages referring to some of the same objects we do. Although the nominalist about numbers lacks number terms, they can still refer to the same pairs of equinumerous concepts that we do. Because the nihilist merely lacks terms for complex objects, they can still refer to the same atomic parts that we do. The terms that determine identity of objects, on Thomason's views, are sortals, like table, chair, number, car, person, etc. Sortal terms are associated with semantic rules that allow us to introduce reference to objects of appropriate kinds, as the semantic rules on your handout do, and quantify over them. There are also semantic rules governing logical connectives, the standard truth conditions, and the quantifiers, the introduction and elimination rules. But in this paper, I'm going to focus on the role of sortals in Thomason's theory. It's key to Thomason's theory that reference is governed by sortals. Every singular term has associated with a sortal concept, such that it is a semantic rule that if that term refers, it refers to an object of the relevant sort. For instance, it is a semantic rule that if Moses refers, it refers to a person, and if gold refers, it refers to a natural kind. This means that the relevant sortals are what some theorists call substance sortals. They apply to an object at all times at which it exists. If an object were to change the basic sortal associated with terms that refer to it, then there could be no term that applies to it before and after the change. It would be impossible for us to say of it that it underwent a change. On Thomason's view, this entails that it is impossible for it to undergo such a change. But Thomason must not only make names dependent upon sortals, but quantifiers as well. Object, according to Thomason, is either a very general sortal of its own, equivalent to something like medium-sized dry good, or it is a dummy sortal that may be replaced with any normal first-order sortal. This doctrine is essential to Thomason's view, for without it, first-order ontological disputes could be reformulated in a way that escapes her deflationary strategy. For consider a world, W, in which all that exists is two mereological simples, P1 and P2. If the nihilist and the universalist about composition formulate their debate in terms of the question, is there a fusion of the two objects, then Thomason's deflationary strategy applies. The universalist has the term fusion in her language, governed by the axioms of mereology, from which it follows that a fusion exists in W. The nihilist either lacks the term fusion in her language, in which she should refuse to assent to the sentence that there is a fusion is true at W, rather than assert its negation, or she possesses this term, but it is governed by different introduction rules, presumably ones that are impossible to satisfy. But in neither case are they properly disagreeing with one another. But this debate could be reformulated as one about whether the following quantified sentence is true or false at that world. Number 4, there is an X, there is a Y, such that for all Z, Z is equal to X or Z is equal to Y. The universalist takes this sentence to be false at W, the nihilist true. Assuming, as Thomason does, that quantifiers and logical connectives have the same meaning in both languages, this would defeat her deflationary strategy, for there would be a single univocal sentence affirmed by the universalist and denied by the nihilist. Number 4. To block this kind of move, Thomason has to hold that the quantificational notion of an object, what can be the value of a bound variable, is relativized to the sortals in a language. Because object is a dummy sortal, to say that there is a third object in the universalist language is effectively to say there is a third simple or fusion. To say in the nihilist language that there is a third object is to say that there is a third simple, because the nihilist language lacks the sortal term fusion. Thus, trivially, the universalist sentence is true, and the nihilist sentence is also true at the world in question. Quantified sentences in a language need to be understood as implicitly quantifying over all instances of the sortals in that language. Thus, when we say, in our language, everything is F, we are, in effect, saying, all of the tables of F are F, all of the numbers are F, all of the people are F, etc., etc., for each of our sortals. So if we really want to get at the idea that Thomason's view internalizes objects within language, we should consider relations between our language and alien languages. By an alien language, I mean a language with logical connectives and quantifier expressions obeying the same formal rules as ours, but whose sortal governing semantic rules differ from those in our language. By a radically alien language, I will mean an alien language that has no sortal governing semantic rules in common with ours. Since the meaning of sortal terms is determined by the semantic rules governing them, and the terms are individuated by their meanings, on Thomason's view, it follows there is at least some difference in the sortals of an alien language and the sortals of our language. A radical alien language, however, has no sortals whatsoever in common with our language. The question immediately arises, must Thomason admit even the abstract conceivability of alien languages? I think that she must, for they are required to sustain an essential component of her positive view. First, I will argue that Thomason must admit the possibility of alien languages, and then I will argue that she must admit the possibility of radically alien languages. The structure of Thomason's explanation of how we can easily know that there are numbers, or the answer to any other a priori ontological debate, is as follows. 5. It follows from the semantic rules of our language that there are numbers. 6. Because of 5, we can easily know that there are numbers. If 5 is truly the explanation of 6, rather than an imprecise statement of some more basic fact that truly expresses 5, then our is doing some explanatory work. If we left it out of five, we would have a different explanation, a point that I'll return to. In particular, the explanatory work it is doing is that of indicating an explanation of why five explains six, i.e., why the fact that it follows from a semantic rule of our language that there are numbers explains why it is easy for us to know that there are numbers. The explanation is that as competent users of our language, we can become explicitly aware of the semantic rules of our language easily. Knowing the semantic rules of one's own language does not require answering any difficult empirical questions, much less any metaphysically epistemic ones. It merely requires making explicit rules one implicitly understands and uses all the time. In this explanation, our is doing crucial work. It is because they are the semantic rules of our language, rather than the rules of some other language, that we can easily determine that they entail that there are numbers. But if our really is doing important explanatory work here, it must have a contrast. It is because it is a rule of our language, not some other language, whose rules we can only master through empirical investigation and learning, that we can easily know that there are numbers, that there are tables, etc. This requires at least the possibility of some language other than our own. Likewise, if I said that the reason we see objects as having the colors we do is some feature of our visual system, I would thereby be committed to at least the possibility of a visual system with a different form of color processing, though there may be limits to how concretely we can imagine it. If our were truly odious, then five would be shorthand for the more precise statement of the explanans, five star. It follows from semantic rules of language that there are numbers. This is not committed to there possibly being multiple languages, of which ours is merely one. However, certain questions arise on such a picture. How do we know we are speaking language? And why are we speaking language? And why is it easy to know the semantic rules of language simpliciter, as opposed to the semantic rules of our language? The natural answer to these questions would, of course, be that seven, language in five star, just refers to whatever language the utterer of that sentence is actually currently speaking. But the structure of this reply requires that language, in its second appearance in seven, when it is used rather than mentioned, refers to a potentially broader class that includes more than just language. In other words, for seven to be an answer to our question, it must be read as tantamount to the claim that among the languages, language refers to whichever one we are actually currently speaking. But this requires that we have at least a general concept of languages, which means that languages other than language are at least conceptually possible. Otherwise, seven reduces to the trivial truth that language in five star refers to language. But this triviality does not explain anything. In particular, it does not explain why we are speaking language, or how we can easily know the semantic rules of language, much less how we can easily know that there are numbers. Thomason does not, of course, deny the possibility of alternate languages. She sometimes invokes them herself in order to highlight the semantic features of our language that enable easy answers to ontological questions. The point of my argument is that this is not a theoretical choice on her part. She must, by the logic of her position, accept that they are at least possible. Now, what do I mean by possible? I mean something like conceptual possibility. I'm not claiming that these other languages have to be metaphysically possible. It has to be consistent with our concepts and the development of those concepts as Amy Thomason sees them, that there be other languages. So Thomason must admit the possibility of alien languages. But must she admit the possibility of radically alien languages? I think that she must. If radically alien languages are impossible, then either A, there is a core of sortal terms in our language that must be shared by any possible language, all possible languages must overlap on this core, or B, although there is no such core, any language must share one or more sortals with ours. All possible languages must overlap with our language, but not necessarily with respect to the same sortals. I think neither option is good for Thomason. For A, leads directly to epistemically metaphysical questions, the very questions Thomason's view is supposed to eliminate. What are those fundamental sortals that no alien language can lack? Empirical investigation will only tell us how much variation there is in languages. It will never tell us how much is possible. For even if cognitive science puts limits on what kind of conceptual schemes could be implemented by human cognitive or neural architecture, it could never determine what such schemes could be implemented by alien cognitive or neural architecture. Likewise, investigation of our conceptual framework will reveal only the rules of our language. It will not reveal what kinds of rules in what kinds of languages there could be. The question of which sortals are had by any possible language is not idle epistemically metaphysical speculation. For it corresponds to questions in traditional metaphysics Thomason wants to reject as confused. Namely, what are the most basic terms in which any creature must think or speak in order to think or speak about objects at all? Admitting such epistemically metaphysical questions would deprive Thomason's view of much of its attention. Even the weaker option B, that any language must share one or more sorals with ours, entails uncomfortable epistemically metaphysical questions. Why must every language share some sorals with ours? What is special about our language? Again, no amount of empirical investigation or conceptual analysis could answer that question, which makes it epistemically metaphysical. And Thomason's whole position is motivated by the desire to avoid such questions. And again, these are not idle epistemically metaphysical questions. For from the point of view of a substantive post-Quinean metaphysician like Ted Sider, they are equivalent to something like the following. Is our universal quantifier so unrestricted that any alien language must be referring to objects within its domain? Do we succeed in quantifying over absolutely everything? Thomason could answer in a Davidsonian spirit that to be a language is to be interpretable, that is to say, translatable into our language. If a language has no sortals in common with ours, then arguably translation will be impossible. No sentence in that language will mean the same thing as any sentence in our language. This would provide Thomason with justification for denying the possibility of radically alien languages. Something similar might lie behind Davidson's rejection of radically alien conceptual schemes, but I won't engage in Davidson exegesis today. But Thomason must then explain her justification for assuming that to be a language is to be translatable, at least in part, into ours. As an epistemic point, this is surely above reproach. Our best and probably only evidence that some pattern of apparently linguistic behavior by a community of creatures is genuinely a language is that it or some substantial fragment of it can be translated into our language. I am not concerned, however, with the epistemic question of whether or how we could know that a radically alien language exists, but whether a radically alien language is even possible. Thomason could reply that it is analytic that a language must be translatable into our language. The concept language only applies to systems of behavior that can be provided with meanings, that is to say, translations in our language. This strikes me as at worst clearly false, and at best dialectically unhelpful, as a claim about our language. For this would entail that language untranslatable into our language is as contradictory, given the rules of our language, as parts arranged table-wise that do not constitute a table is, according to Thomason. But I, for one, am not familiar with any semantic rules of our language that would rule out the hypothesis of alien beings that speak a language that simply cannot be translated into ours and so cannot be understood by us. In fact, multiple science fiction stories have been written about such scenarios without a whiff of conceptual incoherence. By contrast, sci-fi writers have not explored fascinating new worlds in which table parts do not compose tables. The lack of imaginative resistance to such a scenario does not prove that it's impossible. The proof that it is possible, but I think it does shift the burden of proof to Thomason. Given that we can imagine alien languages that we cannot understand, why should we think they are impossible? Finally, Thomason might reply this is simply a stipulation on her part on how she will use the term language. But if that is the case, we can reasonably ask why we should follow her in adopting that stipulation, which in Thomason's system is tantamount to speaking a language in which it constitutes a semantic rule. Against adopting such a language, I would point out that doing so makes it impossible for us to entertain a thought that we can entertain in our actual language. Namely, it is possible that there be a language that cannot be translated into the language we are currently speaking. Unless Thomason's alternate language has another term synonymous with our term for language, there is no sentence in her language that is truth conditionally equivalent to that sentence in our language. That it restricts the scope of the thoughts we can coherently express strikes me as a good reason not to adopt such a language. We should continue to speak a language in which language does not only apply to representational systems translatable into our own. And given Thomason's project of avoiding epistemically metaphysical questions, this means she should admit the conceptual possibility of radically alien languages. Okay, I've argued that Thomason's view must admit the possibility of alien languages, indeed even radically alien ones, that include no sortal terms in common with our language. In this section, I'm going to argue that her view also entails that such languages are impossible because they cannot be languages. There is such a tension at the very heart of her view. Since I'll be focusing almost entirely on radically alien languages, I will just refer to them as alien languages. Alien languages that are not radical, I'm not going to figure very prominently in what I'm going to talk about. There's an obvious sense in which Thomason must deny that radically alien languages can refer to any of the objects we talk about. Since every singular term is semantically associated with a sortal K, and singular terms co-refer only if they refer to the same K, since radically alien languages have no sortal terms in common with ours, Their singular terms are semantically associated with none of our sortals, so they cannot refer to the same objects that we do. We might attempt to get around this point by abstracting from sortals and just using quantifiers. There is an X such that we refer to X, and the aliens refer to X as well. This will not work, for Thomason thinks that quantification is relative to sortals as well. Since by definition, radically alien languages have no sortal concepts in common with ours, this means that no object can be a common object of quantification between us and the aliens. Even using quantifiers, we cannot talk about the same objects that they do. This means that the sentence we originally introduced to express the claim that we and the aliens are talking about the same objects, but merely speaking about them differently, there is an X such that we speak about X and aliens speak about X, is false, according to Thomason's own view. But now the question becomes, in what sense is this language even a language at all? Because speaking our language, there is nothing speakers of that language are referring to. A language is not merely a system obeying certain syntactically specifiable rules for formulation of expressions and transition rules among expressions. It's a way for speakers to make claims about the world. But Thomason seems to have deprived herself of the resources for conceiving of these radically alien languages as being about the world, that is, for conceiving them as alien languages in the first place. There is a natural sense in which this problem arises only because we are formulating it using our language. Obviously, given Thomason's view, which language we speak will affect which objects we can talk about, and this entails virtually trivially that as the formulators of the argument, we will not be able to speak about the objects the alien language is about. In fact, we can't even quantify over them, so the thing I just said suffers from reference failure. So let's examine whether Thomason's view fares better if we, the formulators of the argument, remain neutral between the two languages being compared. Since I don't expect you to all learn a new language, this will be best accomplished if we continue to speak our language while we compare two language frameworks, which we will call L1 and L2. Since it is impractical, and perhaps impossible, to construct a genuinely radically alien language, I will consider two languages with no overlapping sortals within a very small domain of discourse, domain of discourse cars. Language L1 contains the concept of an in-car, which exists when and only when parts arranged car-wise are in a garage. Its use is governed by the following semantic rule, R1 on your handout. This rule allows L1 speakers to introduce names for and quantify over in-cars. Meanwhile, L2 contains the concept of an out-car and the following semantic rule governing its use. There's a mistake on the handout. It should be, there are parts arranged car-wise outside a garage, if and only if there is an out-car. These terms allow L2 speakers to introduce names for and quantify over out-cars. We, let us assume, have all of these rules in our language, as well as, of course, as the more familiar rule, there are parts arranged car-wise, if and only if there's a car. These rules, along with the L1 and L2 rules, allow us to introduce names for and quantify over in-cars, out-cars, and cars. I, of course, failed to construct two mutually radically alien frameworks, for as formulated, the rules allow L1 and L2 speakers to both refer to parts arranged car-wise. This I take to be an artifact of the example, which cannot be eliminated without making it vastly more complicated. More to the point, Thomason herself has to admit that this is an artifact of the example. For if it is genuinely the case that any two language frames must be such that there is a common ontology, a common range of sortals, this raises uncomfortable epistemically metaphysical questions, as I argued earlier. We can make sense of L1 and L2 as languages only because our ontology includes their ontologies as subsets, because we have both in-car and out-car in our language. In other contexts, this point can be used to motivate a maximalist ontology. Always adopt the most permissive ontology possible in order to have enough objects in one's ontology to give the correct truth theoretic semantics for other speakers. But Thomason must reinterpret this pressure for a maximalist ontology as the pressure to speak a maximally ontologically permissive language. When comparing different languages, adopt a more permissive language, one that allows you to interpret both languages as being about objects by incorporating all of their sortal terms and associated semantic rules. From Thomason's perspectives, this is a natural requirement. If you're trying to interpret alien languages, you should adopt as generous, that is to say, as maximalist an ontology as possible, to maximize your ability to give appropriate truth conditions for their utterances. The difference between Thomason and the ontological maximalist is the maximalist thinks this shows us something about the world. The correct ontology is the maximalist one. Thomason thinks this shows us something about language, because on her view, one consistent, empirically adequate language cannot be metaphysically better off than any other. The advantage that the maximalist language has is pragmatic. It enables us to better interpret other languages. But this strategy of always moving to the ontologically more inclusive language finds its limit in the case of radically alien languages, for these are precisely the languages whose ontology we cannot include in ours, because we share no sortal terms in common with them. Other philosophers have written extensively on the problem one faces in giving referential truth conditions for languages whose ontology is intuitively richer than one's own. For instance, the nihilist faces problems in stating truth conditions for sentences in a universalist language, because there simply is no object to serve as the value of the bound variable when the universalist says that in world W from earlier, there is an X that is not identical to either particle. So in some sense, the nihilist cannot give the intuitively correct truth conditions for universalist sentences. Nonetheless, the nihilist can give something like coarse-grained truth conditions for the universalist sentences, a specification of all possible worlds in which that sentence will be true. The universalist sentence, there is a third object that is the fusion of particles P1 and P2, will be true in all possible worlds in which P1 and P2 exist and nothing else does. The question I want to focus on, however, is the truth conditions for sentences in radically alien languages. Not the truth conditions for analytic sentences in those languages, for those will be trivially satisfied, but the truth conditions for empirical sentences of those languages. An empirical sentence in a language is a sentence such that neither it nor its negation is entailed by the semantic rules of the language. Obviously, we cannot know the truth conditions of such alien sentences, since by definition we cannot translate them into our language. But since by hypothesis they are sentences in languages, then they have truth conditions. So the truth condition of such sentences are epistemically metaphysical in Thomasson's sense. No amount of natural science, nor a priori investigation of the semantic rules of our language, will reveal which empirical sentences of an alien language will be true in a given set of conditions and which will be false. This may not trouble Thomasson particularly, since arguably these alien languages are merely possible. Epistemically metaphysical questions about merely possible languages in philosophical thought experiments may not seem so devastating for her view. But we can also ask, what is the range of possible alien languages that include empirical sentences whose truth conditions include a given context? How many different ways are there of speaking truly about what there is in, to take the canonical example of meta-ontology, a world in which there are some parts arranged table-wise? This question is also epistemically metaphysical on Thomasson's view. But the question is the way of, this question is the way of formulating within Thomasson's picture the intuitive question, how many different ways are there for a language to carve up the world? How radically alien from our conceptual scheme can a language be and still be able to make true empirical statements about what there is? But this means that the very structure of Thomasson's view requires her to introduce metaphysically epistemic questions. And these are not idle epistemically metaphysical questions. From the point of view of a substantive metaphysician, these are the epistemically metaphysical questions we were originally interested in. What is there in the world that puts limits on what we can truly say about it? To see this point, consider that the substantive metaphysician has a very easy answer to the question about the limits of what an alien language can talk about, what there is. For instance, the ontological maximalist thinks that for any consistent language, there are objects that this language is about. The compositional nihilist thinks a language can only refer to and quantify over atomic objects and still make true claims. The advocate of reference magnetism, by contrast, might think there's a great deal in the world, but hold that alien languages will not succeed in referring to most of it because most of it is highly unnatural. The idea of Thomasson's neo-Carnapian deflationary approach to ontology is that it is easy to answer ontological questions. One need only appeal to the semantic rules of one's language. No language, as long as it is consistent and empirically adequate, is metaphysically worse off than any other. Intuitively, this suggests a picture on which the world is in itself indifferent to different ontologies, that we can carve it up in any way we wish by speaking different languages with different sortal terms. But part of that intuitive idea is that given a carving of the world, some empirical sentences at some possible worlds with sortals that correspond to that carving are true and some are false. But we can never know what those conditions are. That is to say, we can never know the coarse-grained truth conditions of those sentences. But in this view renders in principle unscrutable the facts about what the truth conditions of sentences using that alien language are. Thomasson can reject all of this naive statements of the intuitive picture as confused. But my, because the world and ways of carving it are just things in our language and they can never refer to anything alien to it, but my detour through alien languages shows, I think, that we can reconstruct the same questions within Thomasson's view. Her view is required, by its very structure, to affirm the possibility of radically alien languages, whose empirical sentences have truth conditions that are unknowable by us, either through a priori conceptual analysis or natural science. The very structure of Thomasson's view reintroduces metaphysically epistemic questions through the back door. But in fact, and I'm now coming to the conclusion, but in fact, things are even worse for Thomasson. For I will argue, she cannot even make sense of radically alien sentences having truth conditions in the first place. A referential semantics supplies a domain of discourse for quantifiers, reference for singular terms, and extensions for predicates. We cannot give a referential semantics for a radically alien language, because by definition, their quantifiers do not range over any objects in our ontology, and they do not refer to any of the same objects that we do. This is not an epistemic point about our inability to know the correct referential semantics for an alien language. It's a semantic point. No model we can give, by definition, can be the correct interpretation of an alien language. There are expressive limitations on our language vis-a-vis the radically alien language, given Thomason's view. But this means there are expressive limitations on our language vis-a-vis the notion of truth in these radically alien languages. Recall that by definition, these alien languages possess logical connectives and devices for quantification. This means their sentences have the syntactic structure that our sentences have and the standard truth conditions apply, 1 and 2 Roman numeral on your handout, where phi is an interpretation function that takes singular constants to their reference and d is the domain of discourse. But this means that our expressive limitations vis-a-vis the aliens with respect to reference ramify into expressive limitations vis-a-vis the aliens with respect to truth. We not only cannot say that the aliens refer to objects we know not what, for by Thomason's own view, this would mean they refer to objects in our ontology, contra hypothesis. We cannot even say they have truth conditions we know not what, for by Thomason's own view, this would mean they have truth conditions of the form 1 and 2, and which would mean truth conditions in terms of our ontology, because 1 and 2 are in our language. The meta-language in terms of which we give the truth conditions for the alien languages have to be ours, and therefore the truth conditions are always going to be involve objects in our ontology. The conceptual connection between reference and truth for sentences of standard syntactic form, specified by 1 and 2, means that the expressive limitations on our language with respect to alien reference entail expressive limitations on our language with respect to alien truth. No sentence we can speak in our language can state radically alien truth conditions. Note further that it is not a problem specific to the standard Tarski-style truth conditions 1 and 2. Any plausible candidate truth conditions for atomic sentences and quantified sentences will be subject to the same limitations. And it's not just that we can't directly state these truth conditions, even if we say there will be some function, that expression function is going to range over sets of ordered pairs of objects in our language. So even the thing when we say there's going to be some truth conditions, where necessarily there are going to be some truth conditions involving the objects in our language. So we can't even express the claim that they will have truth conditions, radically alien truth conditions. Okay, I'm spoken a little bit longer than I want to, so let me just summarize the thing that I was going to say at the end, which is basically just a form of table thumping. One thing that Thomason could do is say, I have a more minimal conception of language. A language doesn't need to have recursively stateable Tarski-style truth conditions. It just needs to be something like a syntactically complex representational system that's differentially responsive to environmental stimuli, to which my response to that is twofold. One, if that's the only way to make the view coherent, that's a serious cost to the view, because the view presents itself as being an articulation of a completely ordinary, highly intuitive conception of things, but that, I take it, is a highly counterintuitive, alienating conception of language. And secondly, I think that my argument from earlier suggests or entails that Thomason has to think alien languages are languages in exactly the same sense as ours. And our language is not merely a syntactically complex representational system differentially responsive to causal stimuli. It's one that also has truth conditions and refers to things. So thank you very much.
Thank you.